Voilà, mesdames, messieurs, bonjour à toutes et à tous. J'espère que vous me pardonnerez de passer à l'anglais désormais, puisque notre invité cet après-midi, enfin ce soir pour lui, ne comprend pas le français. Donc, par égard pour lui, je vous le présenterai en anglais. So, ladies and gentlemen, it's my pleasure to welcome all of you at the Collège de France this afternoon. We're very fortunate to have as a speaker today Professor Bhupinder Shibney, who will deliver an address on the topic Global South, Imperialism and International Law, the Post-Pandemic Era. Professor Shibney is a distinguished professor of international law at the Jindal Global University in India. He's also a membre associé of the Institut de Droit International. He's been a visiting professor at Brown University, Tokyo University, the American University in Cairo, and the Graduate Institute in Geneva. He's been a fellow of various research institutions across the world, including in France, where he visited 2 years ago the French Institute of Advanced Studies in Nantes, where I had the pleasure of meeting him. Professor Shibney's research interests cover general international law, as we'll hear today, including the law on sources and responsibility, international legal theory, international economic law, and international refugee law. But what makes his perspective on international law so unique and so interesting stems both from a focus on issues of global justice and democracy, as we'll hear in his conference today, and from his association with a scholarly movement called TWAIL, Third World Approaches to International Law, which, as you probably all know, is a network of scholars who have developed a critical approach to international law and institutions from the perspective of the South. Professor Shibney's most recent publications include the book International Law and World Order, A Critique of Contemporary Approach, and the co-edited volume International Relations, Essays from the Global South. So thank you so much, Bhupinder, for being with us today. I wish you'd be with us properly, and I think people in the audience as well. But for all the reasons we know, you were hindered from traveling to France, but we're very fortunate to have you live from India with us today. Let me say, before giving the floor to Professor Shibney, that after the lecture, there will be time for questions of the audience. And we'll have 15 to 20 minutes discussion with our speaker. So please stay with us and don't vanish as soon as Professor Shibney's delivered his address. So thank you so much, Bhupinder. We look forward to hearing you.
Thank you, Samantha. Thank you for those extremely extremely generous introduction. I also want to thank you and Collège de France for inviting me to deliver this lecture. As was mentioned, the subject of my lecture is Global South, Imperialism and International Law, the Post-Pandemic Era. I'll begin with some extended introductory remarks that delineate the backdrop and the principal themes of my lecture. In the past 2 years, the COVID-19 pandemic has impacted all of us deeply and in manifold ways. It'll take each of us some time to come to terms with its meaning and consequences. But insofar as nations go, the pandemic has had a relatively harsher effect on developing nations. Vaccine nationalism and big pharma have deprived citizens of the poorest countries of protection against COVID-19. The pandemic has also undermined the efforts of these nations to pull people out of extreme poverty, and in the process has exacerbated inequalities. In short, the peoples of developing nations face a grim post-pandemic future. That is unfortunately the way the global order is structured. Any crisis tends to impact more deeply weak nations and groups. It is difficult to understand this reality without delving deeply into the history of contemporary global order. It calls for grasping fundamental developments that have shaped the present global order since the 16th century. The two principal developments that have molded the present order are the emergence of capitalism and the sovereign state system, or what may be termed the logic of capital and the logic of territory. The logic of capital, as the German socialist thinker Rosa Luxemburg has noted, is internally related to imperialism, as capital requires continuous spatial expansion to sustain the accumulation process. I define imperialism for today's purpose as a set of structures, processes, ideologies, and practices associated with global capitalism that produce dependent and dominated groups, peoples, and nations over time. Between the 16th and 20th centuries, imperialism meant colonization of distant lands, which negated the logic of territory in the instance of colonized nations. The foundations of modern international law, its telos and doctrines, were laid in this period. Even when the sovereignty of colonized nations was restored in the second half of the 20th century, the logic of capital continued its march. New ways were devised in the post-colonial era to align the logic of capital to the logic of territory. The outcome was neocolonialism, that is, imperialism in an era in which the logic of territory was universalized. In the event, post-colonial nations struggled hard to restore a degree of fairness and equity to the functioning of the global order. Their call, for instance, for a new international economic order did not yield the desired outcomes because of the constraints imposed by the global capitalist economy, the doctrines of international law, such as the sources of international law, and the power and diplomacy of advanced capitalist states. In the post-Cold War era, the nature of imperialism underwent change with the arrival of neoliberal globalization. Two key developments took place. First, it saw growing collaboration between the elites of advanced capitalist states and emerging developing nations. This period saw the emergence of what I call a transnational capitalist class, reflecting the growing coincidence of interests between those fractions of the capitalist classes in the global north and the global south that stood to gain from neoliberal globalization. Second, to the extent interests diverged, developing nations were compelled to cede sovereign economic space to a network of international institutions, depriving them of policy options to advance the welfare of their peoples. The result of these two developments is that there are two global fractures today. The first is the geographical fracture indicated by the phrase North-South divide. And the other is a class fracture denoting the division of the world into rich and poor, the empowered and the marginalized. I use the term class here as a composite category, which is inclusive of the gender and race divides in international society. A result of the new phase of imperialism is that the burden of any crisis, whether financial or caused by a pandemic, is borne by the poor and marginalized groups of all nations. It is true that the poor in the global north can benefit from access to some welfare benefits, but the reality is that these benefits are eroding in the neoliberal era, and it is difficult for a significant percentage of citizens in the global north as well to live a life of dignity. In short, when I speak of contemporary imperialism, I'm not speaking only in terms of the North-South divide, but also of the growing class divide signified by increasing inequalities inside and across nations. Imperialism today is as much about the poor and marginal groups in the nations of global north as in the global south. In my view, this trend is going to sharpen in the post-pandemic era, aligning the destiny of the poor and marginalized groups in the global south with those in the global north. This trend will be encouraged by, among other things, the fact that the workings of the logic of capital over time has given rise to a series of other global crises. These include, in particular, the climate and digital crisis, which will negatively impact, again, the global poor and marginalized groups. Both these crises will, of course, affect the poor nation and its people more deeply. In view of the harm done to the economies of developing nations by the pandemic, it'll considerably lower their ability to effectively respond to climate crisis through pursuing the goal of adaptation. And in the case of digital crisis, through seeking what may be termed digital justice for their people. In other words, the climate and digital crisis will greatly compound the crisis that the developing world has to face in the post-pandemic era. But the two crises will, of course, also impact nations of the global north, especially its marginalized sections. It is my contention that modern international law is complicit in producing these disturbing historical outcomes. It has for centuries been the favored instrument of the advanced capitalist states to sustain an unjust global order. The fact that the comprador role of international law is not widely recognized today is because the dominant mode of doing international law is methodological positivism. The positivist method, as we all know, voluntarily deprives itself of intellectual resources that can help analyze the reasons for the different crises that confronts humankind. Unless this epistemic crisis is seriously addressed, the discipline of international law cannot actively contribute to promoting the welfare of the global poor and marginalized sections, or combat, for that matter, the climate or digital crisis. For international law is not merely reflective, but also in many ways constitutive of the global order. In this backdrop, in the rest of my lecture, I elaborate on these arguments in two ways. I begin by offering some further reflections on the epistemic crisis that grips the discipline of international law. Thereafter, I examine four material crises that will greatly impact the world, in particular the developing world, in the post-pandemic era. And these are vaccine apartheid, growing poverty and inequalities, global warming, and the digital crisis. And I'll contend that if international law has to address these crises, there must be recognition that these are linked to the inner dynamics of the capitalist global order. Unless its failings are addressed, we cannot hope for a future world which we'll want our children to inherit. There is an urgent need to call for what sociologist Eric Olin Wright calls the erosion of capitalism. It'll allow us to begin laying the foundation of a post-capitalist and post-imperialist global order, which would be better positioned to deal with these numerous crises. It is to be hoped that the discipline of international law will actively contribute to its construction, that is, construction of a post-capitalist society. But it can do so only if there is an epistemological transformation in the study of international law, or in the discipline of international law. The signs of such a transformation are not there as yet in what I call mainstream international law scholarship. It is expected of students and practitioners of every discipline in times of a general crisis that the world faces today to introspect on whether they have the methodological tools to appreciate the nature, causes, and depth of the crises and formulate effective responses. It can be said with some confidence that in the instance of the discipline of international law, that mainstream international law scholarship, which embraces methodological positivism, has failed on both counts. It neither appreciates the nature and depth of the composite crisis that engulfs the world today, or is in a position to suggest helpful ways forward. The principal reason is, as I mentioned earlier, the refusal to partake of the insights offered by social sciences and humanities. It is worth recalling here that in the discipline of international law, the positivist method became dominant in the last quarter of the 19th century, that is, during the high point of the colonial era. Narrowly focused on state practice, and that too of European states, it was never expected from the beginning to engage with the distributive outcomes of the international legal process or give voice to exploited and subjugated groups, peoples, and nations. In any case, by leaving out the role of the logic of capital in shaping international law, it abandoned a critical base of analysis. Thereby, the positive method obscured the historical connections between capitalism, imperialism, and international law. It left mainstream scholarship free to articulate and legitimize doctrines and rules of international law that assisted the imperialist project. It therefore comes as no surprise today that mainstream scholarship is not in a position to explain or find suitable answers to either growing global fractures or the multiple crises that humanity confronts. It was never meant to. In order to advance effective analysis and responses, what is required is a transdisciplinary dialectical method as against a formalist method which links both the logics of territory and capital over time. The dialectical method lays stress on interconnections or interconnectedness. There are at least three types of interconnections that I have in mind in the discipline of international law. A first set of interconnections is that between state practice or the logic of territory and social classes. The dialectical method does not merely focus on external manifestations of state practice, but lifts the veil over states to examine the relationship between what may be termed internal state practice and international law. It draws attention to the social groups inside a state with the power to influence state policies and through its mediation, shape international law. Put differently, the dialectical method helps analyze the social content of what positivists term state practice and takes cognizance of the class, race, and gender divides in society and its impact on international law. A second type of interconnections is that between the logic of capital and the doctrines of international law, such as the doctrines of state responsibility and jurisdiction. In the colonial era, both doctrines were articulated to protect the commercial and property rights of aliens in semi-colonial and colonial nations. Whether it be the rights of aliens under the doctrine of minimum standard of civilization or the justification of capitulation agreements, a central goal of these doctrines was advancing the interests of capital. It is no different today. The rules of state responsibility incorporated in the International Law Commission's Articles on State Responsibility, adopted in 2001, continue to protect the interests of global capital. Likewise, the doctrine of jurisdiction continues to justify the exercise of extraterritorial jurisdiction by advanced capitalist states in pursuit of the interests of global capital. The problem is that the doctrines and accompanying rules are not designed to address the responsibility of states vis-a-vis the challenges the international order faces today. Challenges that include poverty, climate change, and problematic digital developments. The few attempts that there have been at conceiving doctrines that promote community interests, such as the doctrine of erga omnes, are interpreted in a manner that confines their scope and impact to negative determinations. A final type of interconnection that I have in mind is that between the different regimes of international law, be it environment, investment, trade, intellectual property, or oceans and space. At the analytical level, the dialectical method recommends an integrationist as opposed to a segmented approach favored by mainstream scholarship. The integrationist approach connects and examines different domain areas of international law. It helps understand, among other things, that despite the distinctive issues raised by individual regimes, these are, in the final analysis, intimately linked to the logic of capital. In contrast, mainstream scholarship revels in hyper-specialization. The specialization of skills, as the critical thinker George Lukács pointed out long ago, leads to the destruction of every image of the whole. It actively prevents a unified analysis and understanding of international law. In contrast, a critical integrationist approach helps identify the gaps and flaws in the body of international law that prevent an effective response to different crises. These three tenets of dialectical method are adopted by several critical approaches to international law today, such as the third world approaches to international law, with which I'm closely associated, the feminist approaches to international law, the new approaches to international law associated with names of Martti Koskinen and David Kennedy, and the Marxist approaches to international law. The problem is that critical approaches have as yet only a peripheral presence in the discipline. The situation of TWEL, for instance, is no different from the situation of its counterparts in social science disciplines. Thus, for example, it has been recently observed of development economics that while it focuses on improving the well-being of billions of people in low-income countries, the Global South is severely underrepresented in the field. A small number of rich country institutions have appropriated the field of development economics with serious consequences, and the problem appears to be getting worse. What is even more worrisome is that there is a backlash against even the marginal presence acquired by critical approaches such as TWEL. The current pushback against post-colonial and critical race theory in the US and parts of Europe is an instance of refusal to come to terms with historical realities. The critical theories are being taken to task for allegedly encouraging unconsidered, divisive, and impractical views. However, the underlying reason for the condemnation of critical theories is perhaps the growing demand of marginal and oppressed groups and weak nations for global justice. Unless critical approaches make a headway, there is little hope that international law will further the interests of subaltern groups and nations or help deal with the climate or digital crisis. I will now turn, in the backdrop of these considerations, to the four material crises that may haunt the post-pandemic era to show that the logic of capital continues to shape the global order, a reality, as I have repeatedly mentioned, the mainstream scholarship ignores. The four crises that I touch on, just to remind, are vaccine apartheid, growing poverty and inequalities, and finally, the climate and digital crises. I'll contend that these crises, as I said before, accentuate the North-South divide, and as a sub-theme, also the class, gender, and race divides in the global order. And this trend will continue in the post-pandemic era. I also argue that international law contributes to the composite crisis. Allow me to begin with the first material crisis, which is vaccine apartheid. I begin with vaccine apartheid because the COVID-19 pandemic sharply brings out the nature of the global order and international law. It also shows why, from a developing country perspective, it may even be premature to speak of a post-pandemic era. The storyline is simple. A virus has brought humanity to its knees, but it is being used by big pharmaceutical companies headquartered in the advanced capitalist states to reap super profits. Pfizer, for instance, generated $3.5 billion revenue in the first quarter of this year, of which 20% are likely profits. It means roughly $900 million in pre-tax vaccine profits in the first quarter. The annual revenue of Pfizer for 2021 from vaccines is forecast at $26 billion, indicating immense profits for the company. This unfortunate profiting from people's misery coexists with vaccine nationalism, which has seen rich countries hoard and deprive populations of poor nations of vaccine, even when it is not needed for their own populations. Even the European Parliament adopted a resolution on the global challenge of COVID-19 in June 2021, noting that, and I quote, approximately 1.6 billion vaccine doses have been administered worldwide, the vast majority of which have been in the industrialized and vaccine-producing countries, whereas only 0.3% of the vaccine doses administered globally have been given to the 29 poorest countries, home to about 9% of the world's population, quotes closed. The resolution went on to point out that since in developed countries, all citizens are getting free vaccines, it would be ethically unconscionable if the principle did not apply to much poorer people in developing countries. But poor nations could not afford to pay the price demanded by big pharma companies. Some free vaccines were promised by G7 nations to the developing world. In the COVID-19 summit hosted by the US in September 2021, new pledges were undertaken by rich nations to provide equitable access to vaccines through the global initiative COVAX. But as the Director General of WHO pointed out, it was unlikely that these gestures would help vaccinate 40% of the population of all nations by the end of 2021 as required. At present, less than 5% of the population of Africa has been vaccinated. To reach the figure of 40% requires the dramatic scaling up of access to vaccines, which can only happen if the production of vaccines is also scaled up. It is therefore surprising, and this is important, that the opposition in this backdrop continues to the waiver sought by India and South Africa to the provisions of the WTO agreement on trade-related intellectual property rights, so that vaccine production could be scaled up and the goal of universal access be promoted. It may be recalled that in October 2020, India and South Africa submitted a proposal on waiver from certain provisions of the WTO TRIPS agreement for the prevention, containment, and treatment of COVID-19. After initial discussions, a revised text was submitted in May 2021. The co-sponsors of the proposals now included several dozen nations. In order to facilitate the waiver and to meet the concerns of IPR holders, the new proposal narrowed its scope, stressing that the waiver from TRIPS obligations would be limited to COVID-19 prevention, treatment, and containment. The proposal also accepted that the WTO General Council could assess the existence of the exceptional circumstances justifying the waiver after a minimum period to determine the date of termination. The revised proposal received initial support from the Biden administration. The European Parliament also called for support for proactive, constructive, and text-based negotiations for a temporary waiver of the WTO TRIPS agreement. It further urged the European Commission to ensure the effective transfer of technology and know-how so that supply-side constraints could be addressed. Yet the European Union, backed by Germany, United Kingdom, Norway, and Switzerland, among others, has opposed the temporary TRIPS waiver. It is clear that it is not the values of humanity and solidarity that move these nations, but the interests of big pharmaceutical companies. The result is that the process of waiver is being delayed in the WTO. The outcome is what the WHO chief calls, and the term I use, vaccine apartheid. It is worth recalling here that the developing countries were from the very beginning opposed to the agreement on TRIPS, because among other things, it had negative implications for access to life-saving drugs. But imperialism had its way then as it has now. International law, not for the first time, served the cause of corporations and advanced capitalist states. The doctrine and rules of state responsibility, it's good to remind ourselves, has nothing to say on accountability to humanity. I'll now turn to the problem of growing poverty and inequalities in the post-pandemic era. There is little doubt that the progress made in poverty reduction in the past decades in developing nations is likely to be reverted. Even the most conservative estimates of World Bank, based on poverty line of US $1.9 a day, suggests, and I quote, the COVID-19-induced new poor in 2020 is set to rise to between 119 and 124 million. The real figure of increased global poor may be closer to 500 million people. It deserves to be mentioned that the debate on counting the poor has been going on for decades. A leading critic of the World Bank criteria has pointed out that, and I quote, that its approach, that is the World Bank's approach, to estimating the extent, distribution, and trend of global income poverty is neither meaningful nor reliable. The bank uses an arbitrary international poverty line that is not adequately anchored in any specification of the real requirements of human beings. My suspicion is that a realistic poverty line is not used by the World Bank, not only because the number of poor would increase in the developing world, but it would show the extent of poverty in the industrialized world. According to one economist, and I quote, the latest global data tells us that 85% of the world population lives on less than $30 per day. These are 6.5 billion people. Even at a poverty line of $20 a day, 75% of the people of the world live in poverty. To put it differently, changing the poverty line would disclose the global class divide, which is likely to be exacerbated in the wake of the pandemic. It is also good to remember that the 26 richest people in the world hold as much wealth as half the global population. But even if the World Bank figures were to be accepted, the situation is grim, as additionally, climate change will drive 68 million to 132 million into poverty by 2030. So it's not only the reversal of poverty and the increased poor, but it's also the impoverishment of the marginalized sections as a result of climate change. If the developing countries have to meet the challenge of growing poverty, it would need vast amounts of financial resources. But the priority of rich nations is to augment their own revenues. In this context, it is worth looking at the OECD proposal for a global minimum corporate tax of 15%. The reason given for the proposal is that it will prevent corporations from shifting profits to low tax jurisdictions and help avoid a race to the bottom. But as concerned critics have pointed out, and I quote, the OECD proposal privileges the headquarters countries of multinationals, which are typically the richest countries. They stand to gain more than 60% of the additional revenues, which are likely to be in the range of US $150 billion. What is more, signatories to the OECD agreement are being asked to remove unilateral measures such as digital service taxes on multinational corporations. Finally, there is in the proposed OECD agreement the demand for mandatory arbitration of disputes, which it is feared is likely to tilt decisions in favor of developed countries. Initially, there were some differences among OECD nations over taxation of the digital economy, but the OECD proposal gathered strength. On 1st July, OECD announced that 130 countries were on board. Only a few months later, on 8th October, that's last month, it was announced that the deal had been signed. 3 weeks later, it was endorsed by the G20 group of nations, that is on October 31 in the Rome Declaration. A tax policy expert of Oxfam condemned the deal, stating that it was a shameful and dangerous capitulation to the low tax model of nations like Ireland. It is a mockery of fairness that robs developing countries of badly needed revenue for hospitals and teachers and better jobs. This comes on top of the harm that the pandemic has already done to the economies of the developing countries. Therefore, others have suggested that a higher tax be imposed, and it also be accompanied by a wealth tax on corporate stocks to generate financial resources. But for the present, international law is busy furthering the interests of corporations. The outcome may have been different if the UN rather than OECD was the forum for negotiating a tax agreement, as it would have permitted developing nations to participate more effectively. As a report by the UN High-Level Panel on International Financial Accountability, Transparency, and Integrity for Achieving Sustainable Development Goals observe, and I quote, international tax norms should be established through an open and inclusive legal instrument with universal participation. To that end, international community should initiate a process for a UN tax convention. This observation came before the agreement was adopted. The story of Global North, and this also is an important point, the story of the Global North imposing standards on the Global South is not new. The process has gone on for centuries through colonial legislation, capitulation agreements, and other forms of exercise of extraterritorial jurisdiction. Insofar as tax rules are concerned, a leading expert in global taxation, Martin Hirson, has observed that these have always been written by a club of higher income countries that deny low income countries a fair share. In the past, Global North backed tax standards have been adopted in bilateral double taxation treaties which cover 82% of the world's foreign direct investment stocks, including 81% of the FDI in lower income countries. They set limits on when, and in some cases at what rate, signatories can tax cross-border economic activity, primarily imposing restrictions on the host countries of FDI. The 3,000 odd tax treaties were enforceable in domestic courts and increasingly through a system of international arbitration. Once again, international law has been used by the advanced capitalist states to secure the interests, their own interests and the interests of their corporations. They did so in the past, and they have done so in the present through the agreement which has just been adopted. It is not as if there is no questioning among developing nations of these treaties. Here's a note that Indonesia, Senegal, South Africa, Rwanda, Argentina, Mongolia, Zambia, and Malawi were among those that canceled or renegotiated tax treaties, that is the earlier tax treaties, while others such as Uganda undertook reviews. Further, in 2015, a high-level panel chaired by the former South African president, Thabo Mbeki, on illicit financial flows recommended that African countries review their current and prospective double taxation conventions, particularly those in place with jurisdictions that are significant destinations of FDI, to ensure that they do not provide opportunities for abuse. According to Hearson, it is the beginning of a new, or so he said before the current agreement on minimum tax was adopted, that these moves by the developing nations, in his view, were the beginning of a new counter-hegemonic, intersubjective understanding of the international tax regime that emphasizes unfairness. But he did not reckon with the emergence of the transnational capitalist class, leading to the complicity of the ruling elite in the global south with its counterparts in the global north. The new global tax regime, as I mentioned, will add to the woes of developing nations in the post-pandemic era, for they will be deprived of rightful revenues. What is more, developing nations are also being made to cede the sovereign powers to tax. It means another critical loss of policy space and a gain for imperialism sanctioned by international law. Mainstream scholarship simply does not have the epistemological wherewithal to be critical of these treaties or this existential situation of the poor world. Let me now turn to the third material crisis that I wish to address, which is, of course, the climate crisis, and which, as I have mentioned, is going to add to the woes of developing nations in the post-pandemic era. As we know, the Paris Agreement calls for efforts to limit the temperature increase to 1.5 degrees centigrade above pre-industrial levels, recognizing that this would significantly reduce the risks and impact of climate change. But a recent report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change that you are all aware of, titled Climate Change 2021, the Physical Science Basis, warns, and I quote, that global surface temperature will continue to increase until at least the mid-century, under all emission scenarios considered. Global warming of 1.5 degrees centigrade to 2 degrees will be exceeded during the 21st century unless deep reductions in carbon and other greenhouse gases, carbon emission and other greenhouse emissions occur in the coming decades. There is thus little doubt that unless coordinated and effective measures are undertaken by state and non-state actors to reduce global warming, life on planet Earth may never be the same again. Meanwhile, every passing day, the impact of climate change is being felt the world over. So among other things, rise in temperatures, droughts, floods, wildlife, extreme storms, and so on. And needless to add that consequences for developing nations is often graver because of the lack of resources. The future looks grim if the level of temperatures increase is not kept under required control. But given the past record, it can only be hoped that the ongoing 26th Conference of Parties meeting at Glasgow will come up with suitable measures. But how likely is it that states will prioritize the global common good over corporate and national interests? The Paris Agreement, like earlier agreements on the subject, ignores the fact that the Anthropocene is intimately associated with the rise of industrial capitalism, and that the term Capitalocene, first used by Swedish academic Andreas Malm, more adequately captures the cause of global warming. The problem with the term Anthropocene is that it treats humanity as one unit. But as Jason Moore points out, such a move does not acknowledge that the forces of capital and empire are primarily responsible for the climate crisis. Instead, the term Anthropocene facilitates reliance on a neoliberal regime to address the twin goals of mitigation and adaptation. The preference for the term Anthropocene goes hand in hand with the rejection by the leading capitalist states of the idea of climate justice put forward by developing nations in the course of negotiating the Paris Agreement. The Paris Agreement does speak of climate justice, but only in the preambular paragraph, and that too in a somewhat awkward manner. It mentions, and I quote, the importance for some of the concept of climate justice. It is clear from the phrase for some that it is not seen as a common goal. But without realizing the objective of climate justice, the climate crisis cannot be effectively addressed, as without the cooperation of developing nations, the goals of Paris Agreement cannot be achieved. The concept of climate justice calls for, among other things, a climate regime that adequately responds to several realities, including the historic inequalities in per capita emissions of developed and developing nations, the especially grave effect of global warming on low-income nations, the differential class, gender, and race impact of climate change, the problem of climate displacement and climate refugees, and the need for transferring financial resources and technology to poor nations. But the Paris Agreement does not effectively address any of these realities. That is the case even with the goal of emissions mitigation. Developed states or the advanced capitalist states essentially pin their hopes on market mechanisms by encouraging the vocabulary of carbon markets, carbon offsets, carbon pricing, and carbon capture, involving complex assumptions and calculations about their impact. Put differently, rather than envisioning a move to a new mode of production that can eliminate emissions, the Paris Agreement puts its eggs in the market basket. It entirely ignores the reality on the ground. As the UN Secretary General has noted in his recent report on our common agenda, and I quote, the countries that are members of the G20 provided over $3.3 trillion in direct support for coal, oil, gas, and fossil fuel power between 2015 and 2019. In 2019, 60% of fossil fuel subsidies went to producers and utilities despite government's climate commitments. The result is that fossil fuel subsidies distort prices and risk increasing investment in emission-intensive assets that place the goals of Paris Agreement out of reach. More recently, Nobel laureate William Nordhaus has pointed out, and I quote, even with all of the international agreements of the last three decades, that is the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change of 92, the Kyoto Protocol of 97, the Copenhagen Accord of 2009, and the Paris Climate Accord of 2015, along with 25 conferences, and the 26th is ongoing. Nordhaus suggests over the same period, that is from 92 till today, the rate of decarbonization has remained unchanged. That is, despite all these international legal agreements and 25 conference of parties meetings, Nobel laureate Nordhaus suggests that the rate of decarbonization has remained unchanged. As far as developing nations are concerned, the outcome of the reliance on market mechanisms goes a step further and translates into what has been called carbon colonialism and green grabbing. To be sure, the issue of climate justice or the move to a post-capitalist society has to be addressed with a degree of realism. Yet it cannot be anyone's case that the logic of capital should be the determining factor in shaping global climate policies. The ruling elites of developing countries, I suggest, must reject reliance on neoliberal responses. But the interests of the transnational capitalist class are likely to prevail. The ongoing meeting in Glasgow is not showing any radical departure from the past meetings. To be sure, on the positive side, there is the methane emissions pledge representing 46% of global methane emissions, the declaration on forest and land use, and a joint statement, I believe, of multilateral development banks. But it also needs to be remembered that there is an emission gap of 28 billion tons to be cut in the next decade. But the pre-Conference of Parties pledges only amount to 4 billion tons. And therefore, it's unlikely that any of these pledges are going to be able to address the emission gap of 24 billion tons, even after we account for the pledges. Therefore, these moves are unlikely to enough to meet the urgent situation, especially when G20 leaders meeting only days before the Conference of Parties did not show any urgency. At least one reason for pessimism is that key factors like technology and finance are not adequately addressed, even when these elements of climate justice have been incorporated in the Paris Convention. For example, the promise of a US $100 billion annual climate funding for developing nations promised in Copenhagen in 2009 is still to materialize. It has meant a setback to their adaptation goals. The United Nations Environmental Programme has pointed out that annual adaptation costs in developing countries are currently estimated to in the range of US $70 billion, with the expectation of reaching 140 to 300 billion US dollars by 2030 and 280 to 500 billion dollars by 2050. But at present, even with the limited climate finance made available, only 25% of it is going to adaptation. The transfer of these funds is particularly urgent, as I have repeatedly said, in the wake of the serious consequences of COVID-19 pandemic on the economies of developing countries. And unless this is done, the situation of the developing nations, needless to add, will be grave in the post-pandemic era. But rather than transferring these promised funds at Copenhagen, instead of this, and this is even more interesting, measures are being contemplated which might lower the export earnings of developing nations. For instance, a carbon adjustment tax is being contemplated by European Union nations, which will, in my view, translate into non-tariff barriers against the exports of developing countries. In March 2021, the European Parliament adopted a resolution which states that it supports the introduction of a carbon border adjustment mechanism, provided that it is compatible with WTO rules and EU free trade agreements by not being discriminatory or constituting a disguised restriction on international trade. Despite the latter assurance, a joint statement issued at the conclusion of the 30th basic ministerial meeting on climate change hosted by India of the emerging powers adopted a resolution, and I quote, which expressed grave concern regarding the proposal for introducing trade barriers such as unilateral carbon border adjustment that are discriminatory and against the principles of equity and the common but differentiated responsibilities and respected capabilities principle. In other words, emerging powers did not take the European Parliament resolution at face value. The reason is that developing nations have had a long experience with the use by imperialism of noble objectives to serve parochial ends. It is to be noted that the impact of the carbon border adjustment mechanism will be over and beyond the negative effect of other mitigation policies of the developed world on the goods export of the developing world. And so the scenario, what I'm trying to suggest with these details is that the scenario for developing countries in the post-pandemic era on several fronts looks dismal. And it's important here to, as I said before, to take an integrationist perspective and try and see how international rule, different international regimes can be can accommodate the concerns of developing countries. In this regard, draft Article 10, paragraph 3, paragraph subparagraph A of the International Law Association Declaration of Legal Principles Relating to Climate Change aptly states that it must be ensured, and I quote, legal progress regarding climate, trade, and investment in ongoing negotiations conforms to the principle of mutual supportiveness. But advanced capitalist states do not realize that climate justice is not one of those aspirational goals towards which humankind can work towards in an incremental fashion. The absence of climate justice may mean that the threat of climate change may be accentuated. From the standpoint of the discipline of international law, while the texts like the International Law Association Declaration are a step forward, there is insufficient recognition that only an integrationist approach to international law, which resolves the tension between different regimes in international law and the goals of mitigation and adaptation on the basis of international cooperation, can help fight climate change. You need hard work on all fronts. You cannot do one thing in the climate regime and another in the trade and investment regimes. Equally, what is needed are reformed doctrines of international law, especially that of state responsibility, so that states which do not fulfill their obligations in the battle against climate change can be held accountable. There is thus a need to inject the erga omnes principle with positive content in this regard. As Judge Christopher Veeramanthri observed in his separate opinion in the Gapchikov-Nagimaros case decided by the International Court of Justice in 1997, and I quote, when we enter the arena of obligations which operate erga omnes, international environmental law will need to proceed beyond weighing the rights and obligations of parties within a closed compartment of individual state self-interest unrelated to the global concerns of humanity as a whole. At the level of non-state actors, the ongoing effort to adopt a binding code of conduct on business and human rights needs to be hastened. It will aid domestic courts in the numerous climate litigations which are pending before them so that they can enforce appropriate obligations. At present, courts are turning to the 2011 UN guiding principles on business and human rights, but are constrained by its non-binding status. In short, a holistic view of international law is an imperative if the climate crisis is to be effectively addressed. So on one hand, there is the interests of global capital, and on the other hand, there are the failings of the discipline in addressing the crisis. Allow me now to say a few words on the digital crisis, which is also going to haunt the developing nations in the post-pandemic era. In his well-known book, The Fourth Industrial Revolution, Klaus Schwab has observed that new technologies are today shaping societies in unprecedented ways, be it in the area of communication, work, or leisure. The emerging technologies include artificial intelligence, robotics, Internet of Things, 3D printing, nanotechnology, and so on. But even neoliberal Schwab expresses concern that the fourth industrial revolution could result, and I use this phrase, exacerbated inequality. According to him, there is a danger, and I quote again, of a winner-takes-all dynamic playing out between countries as well as within them. So both the North-South divide and the class divide. In other words, the likely downside of the fourth industrial revolution, as I said, will be a growing North-South divide accompanied by a global class divide. It is therefore understandable that developing nations and their marginalized groups aspire for digital justice. The notion of digital justice includes affordable access of its people to broadband internet, including 5G connectivity in the future, as it will determine access to education, health services, and employment. It means the effective regulations of digital justice also means the effective regulation of digital corporations so that human rights are protected, such as privacy, freedom of expression, and labor rights. Digital justice thus also includes algorithm justice so that, among other things, discriminatory algorithms are prohibited. Digital justice also calls for a multilateral digital agreement which ensures equal benefits for developing nations and therefore does not oppose localization of digital data. Finally, digital justice calls for the creation of a global digital governance system in which weak states can effectively participate in regulatory norm making. The current reality is that none of these goals, which constitute the idea of global justice, are realizable in the near future insofar as the developing countries are concerned, and which, as Schwab himself concedes, is going to exacerbate inequalities between and inside nations. For instance, many developing nations cannot promote affordable access to broadband internet, and it will be years before 5G is made available. At present, according to a report of the Alliance for Affordable Internet, almost half of the world's population remains with no internet access, and many others lack the meaningful connectivity that would allow them to engage in activities like online learning, remote working, and telehealth services. The reason is simple: the lack of resources. As one report points out, it is estimated that achieving universal, affordable, and quality internet access by 2030 across Africa may cost as much as $100 billion. It is also difficult for most developing countries to effectively regulate digital giant platforms such as Facebook Incorporated, now called, of course, Meta Platform Incorporated, Amazon, or Google. Finally, the e-commerce agreement, which is being negotiated under the auspices of WTO, which is seeking deregulation of digital trade, which may result in what has been called digital colonialism. But once again, the digital justice is not only about developing countries. It is as much about human rights of each individual, whether residing in the global south or the global north. In his address to the Human Rights Council in February 2021, the UN Secretary General noted the growing reach of digital platforms and the use and abuse of data. He expressed concern about the commodification of data and the fact that new business models and new industries have contributed to ever greater concentration of wealth and inequality. Finally, he pointed out that our data is also being used to shape and manipulate our perceptions without our ever realizing it. Governments can exploit that data to control the behavior of their own citizens, violating human rights of individuals or subgroups. All of this, as he went on to suggest, is not science fiction or a forecast of the 22nd century dystopia. It is here and now, and he concluded that we need a safe, equitable, and open digital future that does not infringe on privacy or dignity. At present, such a digital future is not on the horizon. There have been some sort of moves forward in the developed nations to protect the human rights of their citizens, especially within the European Union. There is the General Data Protection Regulation of 2016. Again, in April 2021, the European Commission submitted a proposal for regulation by the European Parliament and of the Council for laying down harmonized rules on artificial intelligence and amending certain union legislative acts. The United States has also tried to target the anti-competitive practices of the big tech firms. But from a developing country perspective, at the global level, there is no digital regulatory or governance system. In the circumstances, can most of the developing world escape the creation of what Deleuze called in early 1992, societies of control? Even the World Bank's World Development Report of this year calls for a global consensus to ensure that data are safeguarded as a global public good and as a resource to achieve equitable and sustainable development. Likewise, more recently, the UN Secretary General has proposed a global digital compact, which would outline shared principles for an open, free, and secure digital future for all. This would surely help the developing countries, as I said, by giving them a voice in the process of creating a digital regime which helps protect the interests of its people. This has to be, of course, accompanied by, as in the instance of climate change, the adoption of binding rules and binding rules on business and human rights. The overall effort will be to adopt global rules necessary to constrain corporate digital sovereignty. But as yet, there is no signal that imperialism will compromise on the interests of digital companies for the sake of peoples of the global south or its own marginalized communities. While populist President Trump has been replaced by President Biden, the US commitment to multilateralism and liberal internationalism is far from what it was. So once again, the point I'm trying to make with these details is that while digital technology is going to transform our world, insofar as developing countries are concerned and their marginalized groups, they are not going to be able to benefit from these technology advances. And in fact, maybe the subject of digital surveillance and digital violence. With that, allow me some concluding remarks. The capitalist mode of production has been around for 4 centuries. It is not without its achievements, but the sufferings and oppression it has caused is also without historical parallel. Each of the different phases of capitalism, mercantile, industrial, and now digital, has given rise to internal and international structures of exploitation and oppression. The cumulative impact of these phases is a composite crisis in the 21st century that includes, on the one hand, growing poverty and inequalities in the world, and on the other hand, threats to life and self on planet Earth. In short, the numerous crises are likely to accentuate both the North-South and class divides in the post-pandemic era. The composite global crisis cannot be overcome without the creation of alternative systems of production, distribution, and consumption that are aligned with the interests of the global poor and the global poor and marginalized groups on the one hand, and nature and self on the other. Put differently, what is required is the erosion of capitalism and the effort of constructing a post-capitalist society. However, it is often said that the answer does not lie in undermining the global capitalist system, as it has the ideational and material resources to respond to the multiple crises. It is also said that the talk of an alternative vision by critics from the global South is merely an attempt to shift blame for failed imagination, policies, and practices of post-colonial elites. Such views are not always misplaced, but these are false narratives at the end of the day, in as much as the story of imperialist exploitation in building and sustaining the wealth of industrialized nations is not told. Instead, the development is attributed to the unique culture and institution. The reality is that imperialism over developing nations or nature or individual groups cannot end without the erosion of capitalism. If this radical agenda has to be realized, a coalition of global social movements has to come together and advance the case for the transformation of the global capitalist system. This is easier said than done, as traditional social movements such as the trade union and peasant movements have weakened. However, new social forces challenging state policies are converging around the issues of inequality and the climate and digital crisis. There is growing public consciousness that unless social and political transformation on a global scale is undertaken, these crises cannot be averted. It raises hopes that the citizens of the world will unite to shape a future where each individual can live in dignity. In this scheme of things, finally, international law has to play a critical role. In the past, it has by and large codified rules that support structures of imperialism, legitimated in turn by mainstream scholarship. The process has been facilitated by the epistemological poverty of mainstream scholarship, which deliberately rejects drawing on resources that can help diagnose and address global problems. Therefore, what is called for is no less than the overhaul of the discipline of international law so that it is equipped to respond to the multiple crises that engulfs us. Every doctrine of international law is in need of serious reform. There's also an urgent need to reconfigure legal regimes so that they subserve the global common good. Finally, it needs to reimagine global governance with peoples at the center. Nothing less can ensure that we can address the sufferings and hope of every individual in the world. I'll rest there. Thank you so much for your patience and indulgence. Thank you.